So welcome to VMworld. My name is Olivier Cramel. I've been working with ESX since the CSX One days, and I'm mainly working in platform support, platform enablement. So my talk is going to be focused on the. I can try, or maybe there is some. Okay, I'm. So, as I was saying, my work mainly involves platforms, so my talk is going to be focused on the platform itself. I'm not going to talk about how you can monitor the temperature or stuff like this. I'm just going to talk about when you boot your machine, if there is something that goes wrong, what can it be? What can you do when your machine is up to make it more efficient? The first, so this is the agenda. I'm going to start with the hardware choices. I'm going to talk a little bit about the real hardware versus the virtual hardware, but this is pretty much the only slide I have on virtualization, since I deal with the real stuff. I'm going to explain the differences between the devices that are handled by the service console and the ones that are handled by the VM kernel, and what does that mean. I'm going to talk a little bit about the hardware compatibility list that we have, why we have one, and what does it mean. Then we'll go into some of the installation hurdles that you may encounter, especially with the BIOS and device naming. And finally, we'll go over what kind of events you can expect when you're running your machine, especially with the interrupt sharing or when you want to add new cards to your machine. Okay, so this is, I suppose you are pretty much aware of this, but we still get some phone calls about it, so I'm going to quickly go over this. Virtual hardware versus real hardware. Well, the virtual hardware is a convenient abstraction. As you know, this is something that's really useful because it allows you to hide the real hardware so you don't have to worry about what's on your machine. You can use vMotion to move virtual machines from one host to the next without having to worry about whether the hosts have the same fiber channel adapters. You can also obviously simplify the way software delivery is made, and that's what the virtual appliance is all about, because you no longer need to worry about supporting all the hardware that's out there. You just can optimize your virtual appliance to run on the virtual hardware. So the real hardware itself has almost no impact on that virtual hardware. For instance, the virtual storage in your virtual machine is a SCSI based. So you have a SCSI control, a virtual SCSI controller, and you have virtual SCSI disks. Whether or not you have actually SCSI controllers on your real machine, we have customers sometimes asking us, well, I have a fiber channel adapter in my machine and I cannot see it in my virtual machine. So this is obviously one of the examples of the fact that the virtual hardware has no relationship with the real hardware. The fact that you have fiber channel or iSCSI or SATA or whatever as storage in your real hardware has no bearing on the virtual hardware. Another example is the networking. The virtual networking in the virtual machine will advertise the gigabit speed regardless of what your actual hardware is doing. Your actual hardware may be just 100 megabits, or it can be 10 gig, or it could be even software in case of a virtual switch which connects virtual machines without going outside. Likewise, you don't need a very fancy graphic card in your machine. This will have absolutely no impact on the graphics of the remote console. So when I said almost no impact, there is at least one exception. It's the processors. You will, in your virtual machine, you will know whether you run on AMD or Intel, for instance. So that being set aside, we are now going to talk about the real stuff. So when you boot your machine, ESX3 is fairly different from ESX2 in the way the machine is handled, in the way the devices are managed. With ESX3, when you boot your machine, you start, the bootloader loads the initial RAM disk, you start booting the Service Console kernel, which is a Linux kernel, from the initial RAM disk, and then we will load the VM kernel and take over the machine. We are still in the initial RAM disk at this point, so you reach a point where the machine is now handled by the VM kernel, the Service Console kernel is still running, but on top of the VM kernel, and you are still in the initial RAM disk. We haven't touched any of the actual devices in the machine yet. So at this point, we actually are going to load the drivers for the storage and for the networking, and they are going to be VM kernel drivers. And when those drivers are loaded, we will then mount the root file system and continue booting the Linux kernel of the Service Console off the boot disk, which means that it's a big difference between ESX2 and ESX3. In the case of ESX3 now, all your storage devices, all your networking devices are handled by the VM kernel. In the case of ESX2, you could dedicate or you could share a network card or a storage controller with the Service Console, and you would actually have add a driver for that NIC or for that storage controller running in the Service Console. Nowadays, you don't have any drivers for those devices in the Service Console. So the VM kernel is actually exporting an abstraction, and that's what the Service Console is using. So you can say, in a sense, that the Service Console is also using a virtual NIC and a virtual storage adapter. Besides the networking and the storage devices, pretty much all the other devices are handled by the Service Console. So that obviously covers the keyboard, mouse, video, and sound. It also covers what we call the slow devices, like the CD-ROM, the floppy controller, the serial power interface. One of the most important that's left is the USB, and we'll talk about a little bit about USB later because it has some impact. Anything that has to do with the motherboard itself, so IPMI, for instance, or all the drivers that are installed by the management tools, OEM management tools like OpenView or Director. And anything you want actually to add to your ESX installation, like for instance if you have an interruptible power supply that you want to monitor, then the driver for it, if you want to install it, would be also in the Service Console. Now, what does that mean for a device to be handled by the VM kernel or by the Service Console? Well, it's mainly a matter of how fast you get to it and how you use it. Anything that's handled by the VM kernel, you have direct access from the VM kernel. That's why networking and storage is handled by the VM kernel, so that the virtual machines can access, not directly, but through the virtualization layer, those devices without incurring the cost of going to the Service Console. On the other hand, if you have a device that's handled by the Service Console, like the floppy or the CD-ROM, then each time you use it, let's say you have a virtual machine and you want to connect the real floppy drive from your host because you want to install floppy and add it visible in the virtual machine, then the virtual machine will have to go through the VM kernel and then through the Service Console for each access. So it's much slower. So I know a lot of people are always asking us, why are you supporting such a limited number of devices? So one reason we do this is because we want to be absolutely sure that our ESX software runs well on the machines that we support. And I'll go into this a little bit later, but you'll see that we restrict actually running on some machine where we could actually run just fine. One big reason why some hardware is not supported is pretty much driver availability. You need a driver for the VM kernel in case of storage or networking. So if you don't have a driver, if your NIC doesn't have a driver for the VM kernel, obviously we cannot support it. And as I said, and we'll get into this later, on most of the non-supported platforms would actually run ESX probably just fine. We just don't want to run on them without making sure it runs perfectly. That means we have a lot of restrictive checks. We do explicit checks when we load the VM kernel to make sure that you actually do not try to run on a machine that we haven't tested. One example is, for instance, I run ESX on my laptop, and I have a coworker that's also, he's got a laptop, and his laptop is using a VIA CPU. And he's complaining, he said, I cannot run ESX on my laptop, can you do something about it? Well, it probably would work just fine, but we explicitly check that you are running on AMD or Intel CPUs. And again, the reason is because we have tested on AMD and Intel CPUs, so we want to make sure you run them. Those restrictive checks mean that sometimes you may see some warnings or alerts when you boot your ESX system that may be spurious, in the sense that we've checked for something and we detected that it's not quite what we expect, but depending on your platform, it may actually be harmless. And I'll give you some examples later. So, given those checks that we perform, this means that there's a certain numbers of constraints that you have to be aware of when you decide on what kind of hardware you're going to choose to run ESX on. For the processors, for instance, at least for now, we have a fairly strict policy of mixing and matching. The CPUs must be fairly closely identical. They can be of different steppings depending on the models. Not all models support different steppings, but they should be fairly close. You cannot really mix and match different kind of CPUs. The BSP is considered the CPU that will give us what all the CPUs support. So it should be the least capable of all the CPUs. So if you have CPUs with different features, the BSP must be the least capable because it's the one that's going to tell us what you can support. And I'll give you an example of what that means later. The memory is, you can pretty much do anything as far as the memory is concerned, except for one big caveat when NUMA systems are involved. So a NUMA system, a non-uniform memory access system, is a system in which not all memory has the same speed as far as CPUs are concerned, because memory is local to nodes. So you may be aware of the big systems from IBM, for instance, which are made of different physical nodes in which you have memory on each node and you have big cables going around to interconnect the nodes together. And so if you have one of those systems, you definitely know it's a NUMA system. But what you may not be aware of is that all the AMD Opteron-based systems are de facto NUMA systems, because the Opterons include the memory controller with the CPU, which means that the memory is local to a CPU. So when you have a four Opteron-based system, you have memory for each CPU, and the memory for one CPU is faster for that CPU than it is for the other CPUs, the access. And we have one big restriction that's driven because of performance reasons is that the memory must be balanced. We don't want to have like all the memory in one node and no memory in the other nodes, because that would mean that the CPUs in the node where all the memory is have faster memory than the CPUs on the nodes where there is no memory, which means that as VMs migrate from one CPU to another inside the machine due to scheduling activity, they could experience suddenly they were fast and suddenly they become slow. So when we boot the machine, we actually check the amount of memory in each node, and if we find out that there is a significant difference between the nodes, we actually will refuse to load the VM kernel. Which means that if you have an AMD based system, you need to make very sure that your memory is balanced across all CPUs, otherwise the ESX kernel will not load. devices, so obviously we need a VM kernel driver if you are choosing a NIC or a storage, but you need also to pay attention to anything that could tie up your VMs to a specific host. Now USB is a good example. You may have software that requires USB dongles that you plug into a USB port to enable the software to run, some kind of licensing scheme. Now if you actually use the local USB on the host and you plug the dongle on that host, and if you run a VM and you make that USB appear, then obviously that VM now is going to be tied up to that host. So for that kind of usage, what you actually should do is do something like USB over IP, where you can put all your USB devices that you're interested in somewhere else, and then you have them accessible through the IP network to any host you want, which means that if one VM was using one of the USB devices, then they could be vMotioned to another host and still see the USB device through the IP network. Okay, so let's go through actually using the machine. So when you're going to install ESX and when you're going to boot for the first time, one thing that's very important is the BIOS. And actually, in my work where I get machines, new machines, that basically I'm asked, okay, can you make ESX run on that machine? Most of the issues we encounter are BIOS related. So I just want to emphasize that BIOS is extremely important for the machine to run well. Why is it important? Well, the BIOS contains, the BIOS is basically what's going to tell the operating system what the machine is all about. It will give the operating system the processor list, it will give it the memory configuration, and more importantly, it will give it the interrupt routing information, how to get interrupts from devices. In the case of the So all that information is available through two main mechanisms. One is called MPS, that's the multiprocessor specification. It's the older mechanism, it's like at least 10 years old, I think. And the new one is called ACPI. Now ACPI, most people are familiar with ACPI as far as power management is concerned, but it does a lot more than power management. It also gives us that kind of information. Now, in the case of ESX 3, what we use to get that information from the BIOS is the MPS mechanism. Unfortunately, MPS is no longer well supported by the OEMs because they much prefer to use ACPI, and because MPS is a lot more restrictive than ACPI is. Which means that we are much more liable to BIOS issues than another operating system would be. which means it's very important to make sure that you have the very latest BIOS installed to make sure that all the bugs or quirks that could be in the BIOS have been ironed out. So not only is it important to make sure that the BIOS is good and that the machine is going to be able to use the information provided by the BIOS, but it's also very important to look at some of the BIOS settings. It turns out that the BIOS is pretty much the only mechanism that OEMs have to influence the operating system. So sometimes when they come up with new hardware, they want to make sure that that new hardware will be able to run on the existing operating system. But the existing operating system may not be aware of the new hardware because they haven't been updated, right? So they will often try to find ways to tweak the BIOS to basically fake the hardware to be different than what it really is so that the operating system will not be confused. So one example is disabling NUMA on Opteron-based systems. On most machines using the AMD Opteron system, CPUs, you can go into the BIOS and you can choose a setting that will, usually it's called something like memory interleaving, which basically will tell the BIOS, try to hide all notion of NUMA from the operating system. So that when the operating system boots and gets the information from the BIOS, it will think that the machine is not NUMA. And if the operating system is not NUMA aware, that's what you want. Now, obviously, if you do this, either by mistake or because that's the default setting in the BIOS when you get the machine, you also prevent an operating system that's NUMA aware, like ESX is, to take advantage of the NUMA architecture. We do take advantage of the NUMA architecture because we always try to keep the memory and the VM on the same node so that it's more efficient. One other example is the limiting of the CPU ID leaves. Now, CPU ID is a mechanism by which CPU vendors report features for CPUs. So they started with just like one page, and then they added features and features, so they need more pages. Those pages are called leaves. So if you have an operating system that's not aware of that, they may look at the CPU and they may ask the CPU, okay, give me all the leaves for the CPU ID. And if the operating system expects like 3 leaves and the CPU returns like 5 leaves, the operating system may just crash there. So you also have an option in the BIOS to do the limiting. Again, this may be the default option because usually the way the BIOS is set up is to make sure it runs on the widest possible range of software out of the box. And again, we want to see all the leaves because we want to be aware of all the CPU features. Another example is the reordering of the BSP. So you remember I said earlier that we depend on the BSP being the least capable CPU. So in some BIOS, you don't have to open your box and say, oh, I made a mistake, that CPU should have gone in that socket. You can actually go into the BIOS and you can tell the BIOS to reorder the CPUs without actually opening the machine. It will just logically present a different CPU as the BSP. Finally, I mean, there are lots of other options, but this is all the important examples. There's also MPS limitation. It's less likely these days because MPS is not as prevalent as it was before. But there used to be an option in the BIOS to actually limit the amount of I/O epochs, the number of I/O epochs that the BIOS would present to the operating system. And again, we want to see all the I/O epochs. So what you have to basically take from this is that you have to make sure that by mistake or just by default, you don't have a BIOS option that's not what you want. And actually, for some of them, we'll print warning or even refuse to load the VM kernel if we detect some of them. Okay, so let's say the BIOS is fine, so you started installing ESX. And one of the first things that we're going to do when you install ESX is we're going to find out all the devices that are going to be used by the VM kernel, so networking and storage, and we're going to give them names. Now, in the case of ESX 2, the names were created on the fly as the drivers were loaded. So VM NIC 0, for instance, would have been the first NIC that was found by the VM kernel when the VM kernel was loading drivers. That means that the names were non-persistent. If for some reason you would reorder the way the drivers were loaded, your VM NIC 0 would be a different NIC the next time. With ESX 3.0, we've changed the way the naming is done. The names are created during installation. So during installation, we find out all the NICs and all the storage controllers, and then we give them names, and we use the PCI addresses as a key to decide a mapping between names and devices. So if we find a NIC, for instance, in the PCI address bus 2 slot 5 function 0, then we will have a mapping in the ESX.conf file saying, okay, 250 is VMNIC 0. This means that now those names cannot change for any software reasons. Even if the drivers are reordered, the names will stay the same. That doesn't, however, mean that they are still completely immutable. It's still possible to get into trouble if the hardware changes, because adding or removing a PCI card may actually cause a bus renumbering and may change all the PCI addresses. So this is actually a fairly big problem, something that we will address, but right now we have to deal with it. So the buses, the PCI buses, are animated by the BIOS. So the BIOS goes and discovers the machine and says, okay, this is going to be bus 0, bus 1, and so on. If the BIOS, so it depends very much on the BIOS, and it depends very much on the way the BIOS is done. And I can tell you that for some OEMs, you will never get into that problem, and for other OEMs, you will get into that problem. However, I won't tell you which OEMs, because that would be bad. So if in the good case, basically they make sure that when they enumerate the PCI buses, they leave holes. So they would not say like this is 0, 1, 2, 3. They will say this is bus 0, this is bus 5, this is bus 10. So that when you add a card that is a bridge card, that is a card that has a PCI bridge and bus is behind that bridge. So usually it's multifunction cards, like if you have a quad NIC, it could be done as just four functions in a single PCI device, in which case you don't have anything to worry about. But most of the time it's done as you have a PCI bridge on that card, and then you have a PCI bus behind that bridge, and then you have four PCI devices on that bridge for each one of the ports. Now if you plug in that card in your machine, suddenly there's a new bus in the machine. So when you reboot the machine and the BIOS enumerates the buses, it will find that new bus. So depending on how it does it, if you have holes, well, it will become like bus 3 between 0 and 5, which is fine, because all your devices with their names, they haven't moved buses, right? So the names are still mapping to the same PCI addresses. On the other hand, if for some reason the BIOS decided, okay, the buses are 0, 1, 2, 3 as I discovered them, then suddenly that card may become bus 3, and the old bus 3 will become bus 4. So now your VMNIC 0, which was mapped to 350, it's going to be something else. So some random device now on bus 3 will be called VMNIC 0. On the other hand, your real VMNIC 0, which is now in bus 450, will not have a name because we don't have a mapping between 450 and any device. So that has two consequences. The first one is obviously we're going to try to use a device that's not the device intended, and also the device you want to use, you won't be able to use it because it has no name. In the case of a neck, that's annoying, but at least you can boot. In the case of the storage controller, you may actually not be able to boot anymore, because it's possible that it's your VMHB 0 that's been renumbered, which means that the VM kernel will not find it anymore, which means it cannot load the driver, which means that you won't be able to access the boot partition, which means you're going to get stuck there and the boot process will be stopped. So this is very important. So if you want to, and this works the other way also, obviously, if you remove a device, you can also cause renumbering of PCI buses. So if you want to change the hardware configuration of your machine, you have to be very careful to follow the procedure that's outlined in the documentation. Very often people just assume, and I guess I kind of fault them for that, that they can just shut down the machine, plug a new card in, and power on, and everything will be fine. But we have actually a very specific procedure that you need to follow when you want to make changes to your hardware to avoid getting into those issues. It's in the ESX3 manual. I don't know what it's called, but it's the big ESX3 user's guide or whatever it's called. I don't know. Okay, so I'm going to go over some specific examples of all I've described. So you boot the machine, and as I said, you go through the loading of the Service Console Linux kernel on a RAM disk, then you load the VM kernel, and the checks are done by the VM kernel. So it's very possible that the Linux port will go fine, but then the VM kernel will decide, oh, by the way, I don't like that CPU. And the VM kernel loading will be aborted and will return an error, and then the whole booting process will be interrupted. So I give you some examples of the checks that we do, like the unbalanced to memory or the CPU, or for instance, one of the BIOS options I gave an example of, the CPU ID limit. One other big example is the interrupt information. If, yeah? Yes. Yeah. I don't remember the exact number, but it's fairly small. I think it's like 10%. Okay. So if you have more than 10% differences between nodes, we will say no. Do something about it. So for instance, if you have like 2 gig, 4 gig, 4 gig, 4 gig, you'll fail. Okay, so interrupt information, we'll get into it a little bit more when I talk about interrupt sharing, is another big piece of information that when it's missing, it will prevent the VM kernel from loading. When I say missing, I don't mean it's completely missing. I mean we have found a device, and for some reason the BIOS doesn't give us any information about that interrupt for that device is routed. The second example is the example I gave you earlier, is that if you've changed your hardware configuration and somehow your boot disk is beyond a control, it's been on a bus that's been renumbered, then we won't find it and you would fail to boot again. So when that happens, when the VM kernel decides, okay, I cannot boot, it will return an error and the boot process will be stopped, and you'll get into a so remember, we are still in the initial RAM disk at this point, because you can't get to the boot disk as long as you don't have a VM kernel driver running for it. So if the VM kernel fails to load, obviously you cannot have a VM kernel driver, so you don't have the boot disk. So we actually fall back to a simple shell, and at this point you can, I think it's also described in the user's guide, you can actually do a couple of look at a couple of logs to try to find out what's going on. And I think that you have an example. Yeah. So in the log, we will actually print a message, hopefully a helpful message, about the reason why the VM kernel failed to load. So the first example is the example related to the NUMA memory balancing. So the message will look exactly like this. I just copied it from the source. So it will say, for instance, no page is allocated to node 2. That means when we've done the checks, we've looked at the amount of memory on each node, and we found out that, well, there was no memory on node 2. The point is that we don't really know why there was no memory on node 2. So there is different reasons. So that's why the message is like, okay, we didn't find any memory, but, I mean, your guess is as good as ours as to why there is no memory. So it may be a BIOS error. The BIOS may simply tell us there is no memory on node 2, even though there is memory in node 2. That's what the BIOS and FLAT memory map mismatch mean. It could be an MTR error for some other BIOS did not set up the MTR correctly in the CPUs. Or it could actually really be that you have a node where there is no memory. So that's why the helpful message is, well, try checking the memory or upgrading the BIOS. I would advise to check the memory first. Another example is unsupported BIOS settings, CPU ID is limited. That's the one I gave you earlier. We actually detect, there's actually a way to detect that. So if we find out that for some reason some of the CPU leads are not visible to the operating system, we will actually fail to load and we will print that message. Again, the helpful hint is that try to find it in the BIOS. The point is that we cannot really tell you more than this because depending on the OEMs, the BIOS setting may be called something completely different. So usually what you can do, so this is, I should point out that this is the message you'll see in the log. Usually you can then go to the website and the knowledge base, and usually this will map to an article that will actually give you the exact phrasing of the BIOS option for different machines. Obviously, we don't want to put all that in the code, but you can actually go and find out. Another example is the unsupported CPU, where we would, for instance, say unsupported CPU name is VIAC7 or whatever. Okay, so sometimes, even when we detect that something is not what we want, we will not cause the boot to fail. We will just either print an alert, which is the red messages you can see on the local console, or we will just have a warning, which you can see in the VM kernel log. And we do this when we find out that, okay, there is something that we don't like, but we think that it's we can still kind of run with it. It may not be good. That's why we print the alert, to kind of let you know, okay, there is something that may not be okay with your machine. Maybe you should check, but we go ahead. Actually, some people have asked us to do this for the NUMA. And we don't do it by default, but there is an option that you can select when you boot the VM kernel that will tell the VM kernel, okay, if there is a NUMA, a memory balancing issue, print the alert, but keep on going and run. The reason why it's not the default is because often people don't look at the alert for the warnings, and they will run with the machine. And then they will complain and say, oh, the performance is really bad on that machine. So we prefer not to make that the default. So for the ones that we actually allow to go through, we are fairly sure that the machine is going to be all right, but we still want to kind of alert the user to it. Also, one of the reasons why some of them we kind of let them through is because some of them may be spurious. An example is the PCI setup, interrupt setup failure. When we discover all the devices in the machine, we check for each device and we ask each device if they can interrupt or not. And for each device that tells us I'm an interruptive device, we then ask the BIOS, okay, that device told us it could send interrupt. What's the interrupt routing information for that device? And if the BIOS then tells us I don't know anything about that device, I don't have any interrupt routing information for that device, that means we will never be able to use interrupts for that device. So we actually print a warning saying, okay, PCI interrupt setup failure for that device. Now, it turns out that some devices are actually lying. They are telling us they are interruptive, but actually they are not. And unfortunately, it's kind of difficult to know which one are which because there are always new devices coming up. So over the years, we've identified some classes of devices like this. Like we used to print that message for SMBus devices, for instance. We don't print it anymore because we've found out that they will always lie to us. So that's an example of where we actually print the warning instead of failing to boot because we are never completely sure that it's harmless or not. Again, if you get that message, you can go to the knowledge base and we will actually, as we discover them, we will actually list the ones for which we think that the warning is not a problem. And actually, when we do this, in the next release, we actually remove the warning. So there are fewer and fewer warnings as we go along. If by looking at the knowledge base, you still don't see, like for instance, one thing you can check for sure is that when you get that message, we will actually give you the PCI address of that device. So you can then do an LSPCI and see, okay, what kind of device it is. Obviously, if it's a NIC, for instance, that should be interrupted. There's no doubt about it. That means you won't be able to use that NIC. So you know for sure there's a problem. Okay, so the warning and alerts, usually you will not get any, or you may get a bunch of them like this at boot time. And then when the system is running, hopefully you don't get any, but you may get some when the system is running, and there are two classes that are related to hardware. The first one is the machine check exception, so you will see an alert, sometimes we will even panic, saying a machine check exception occurs in the machine, and that's usually a pretty good indicator that something is going wrong with the memory. Likewise, there is a heartbeat loss, which is a detection mechanism for CPU lockups. So one example, sometimes we've seen cases where it happens because the memory is bad. I'm not saying that each time you get a heartbeat loss, it's because the memory is bad, but it's possible. Okay, interrupt sharing. So I hinted at this earlier. The VM kernel is in control of the machine, and the VM kernel gets all the interrupts. So even though some devices are handled by the service console, it's still going to be the VM kernel that's going to fill the interrupts. The interrupts, we actually use a software mechanism to balance the interrupts. So we don't use the hardware CPU-based mechanism that allows the CPU to choose which CPU to send the interrupt from. We always target a specific CPU, and the scheduler is actually responsible to decide whether it wants to change that CPU from time to time. This is per interrupt. I'm not saying that all the interrupt goes to a specific CPU at any given time. For each interrupt, they go to a specific CPU, but this could be different CPUs, obviously. It's policy driven, so you can actually change the way the scheduler makes the decision about the interrupt targeting. So once we get an interrupt, once the VM kernel gets an interrupt, the VM kernel will invoke the device drivers, the VM kernel device drivers, and if the VM kernel finds out that the interrupt is also used by a service console device, then it will forward that interrupt to the service console kernel. So basically it will fake it for the Linux kernel. It will make it appear as if the kernel and the Linux kernel has received an interrupt. It's all software based. And so the service console then will be responsible to dispatch that interrupt to any device drivers that would use that interrupt in the service console. As far as the VM kernel is concerned, the service console is just one big blob, so it doesn't actually know which devices are using that interrupt. So what may happen is that you may have interrupt sharing. So it's possible that several VM kernel devices may share the same interrupt, or it's even possible that the VM call and the service console may share the same interrupt. So I'm going to give you an example. So this is a printout of the proc VMware interrupts node that you can look at in the service console. And what it tells you is basically, so on the left you have the vector column, that's all the interrupts that have been set up for that machine. And then you have counters per CPU, so it's the number of interrupts for each vector that have happened on each of the CPU. And then you have the devices that are interested in those interrupts. So in the case, for instance, the first vector, 21, you can see that it's used by the service console, CAS, Control OS, that's the old name, IRQ1. So we don't tell you which device it is, we'll find out later, because remember, as far as the VM kernel is concerned, it's just one big blob. And it's also used by a VM kernel device. Now, the brackets means that, sorry, the brackets means that the interrupt has been set up but is not currently used. So to go back to the first line, this means that this vector currently is used by a service console device. There is a VM kernel device that could use it but is not currently active, either because the driver has not been loaded or because it's been disabled. This second line, for instance, says this interrupt has been set up for the service console device, but that service console device is not active right now. So the third line is an example where you have a service console device and a VM kernel device that are using and both active at the same time. Then here you have another example where you have a console device that's not active and a VM kernel device. And here you have examples where you have two VM kernel devices sharing the same vector. So a NIC and a fiber channel adapter sharing the same interrupt vector. So if you actually, if you look at the so the service console column, you can actually find out which they are by just looking at the usual Linux proc node, which is the proc interrupts. So careful, one is proc VMware interrupts, the other one is proc interrupts. So the IRQ1 was actually the keyboard, and IRQ11 was USB. So if we go back, so you can see that actually this machine is very well configured as far as service console is concerned, because the serial you don't really care about, because serial is just for debugging, and you can see that there is no service console devices currently active that's sharing an interrupt with a VM kernel device. So why could this be a problem? Well, when you share an interrupt, when two devices share an interrupt, this kind of limits the usefulness of the balancing mechanism, because if you have an interrupt that's shared between a NIC, for instance, that's used by one VM, and a storage controller that's used by another VM, those VMs may not necessarily be on the same CPUs, they may be scheduled differently. So we lose the possibility of having the interrupt follow the VM, because it has to follow one of them, right? So that means you lose a little bit of the advantage of rebalancing there. Also, the really bad case is that if you have a device, a VM kernel device that's sharing an interrupt with the service console, then the interrupt itself cannot be rebalanced at all. For technical reasons, any interrupt that could be used by a service console is always going to the BSP. It cannot move outside of the BSP. So, what does that mean? Well, that means that, obviously, if you share an interrupt between different VM kernel devices, each time we get that interrupt, we have to call all the device drivers for that interrupt. So if you share an interrupt between a VM kernel NIC and a storage adapter, with the NIC interrupting like crazy, as is often the case, on each of those interrupts, we also call the device drivers for the storage controller. if you happen to share it with the service console, well, it's even worse, because now on each interrupt, not only are you going to call the VM call device drivers, but you're also going to call into the service console, which means you can have context switch into the service console, or the service console do its own thing and then come back. So unfortunately, there's not much you can do about it. It's very much tied into the way the machine, the motherboard, the chipset has been set up and programmed by the BIOS and the OEM. What you can do is try shuffling cards around. Very often the interrupts are tied to physical slots. So by just moving a card to a different slot, you may just prevent the sharing. Another thing you can do, especially for the service console devices, is to actually try to have as few as possible of those devices. If we go back to this one, you see that on this machine, there really is, you don't really care about the keyboard and the mouse and the serial, because those being all ISA devices, you are guaranteed they are never going to be shared with the PCI devices. So really the only thing you care about is the USB. So the USB is really usually the thing to look for. So USB has often been a problem. More often than not, when the interrupt sharing has caused performance issues, it was because it was shared with the USB driver. Now, if you don't use USB, one thing you can do is actually disable the USB devices in the BIOS. The problem with that is that most of the remote management tools like ILO and I don't remember what the IBM one is called, they use USB to emulate their remote access. So most of the time now you cannot do this. So there is actually some hope for interrupt sharing in the form of MSIs, which is message signal interrupts. And we'll address this later. It's not in ESX 3.0. So that's pretty much it. Yeah, that's pretty much it for this. So any questions about any specifics?
Do you find that more interrupt sharing issues on
I cannot reply to this question because I cannot tell you anything about who is better and who is not.
What about data? Are you guys support data?
I don't want to say I cannot reply to this either, but I guess I'm not really. We are looking at all the devices to support. Devices as customers require them. So I cannot tell you when we will support it or in which release or anything like this, but we are looking. Yes? Yes. Yeah, it's actually a known problem. I think it's. Did you check the knowledge base?
No, I haven't yet.
Yeah, I think there's an article about it. It's related to the way the it's a proc node in the service console to access the real time clock. That's if I remember correctly, it's because the it's not set up with the right permissions. So if you go to the knowledge base on the VMware website. You should be able to you just give that message and you should be able to find the article about it. Okay, well, thank you very much. Have a nice day. Enjoy the rest of the show.